family's farm with the production of natural gas on their land. Thinkaboutit.org.
This is The Daily Circuit. I'm Carrie Miller along with Tom Weber. How do you build a great teacher? A Harvard scholar thinks he knows how, and he's going to join us. He's out with a new book called The Allure of Order. It's going to be a little controversial, I think, with the educators in the audience, Tom.
We're also looking over what went down, what didn't happen here in the final days of the legislative session. And speaking of education, we're going to go over that budget and what happened in the world of education this year at the state capitol. That will all happen after a check of regional news. Minnesota lawmakers, though, took all the time the Constitution allows to finish their budget work and end this year's session. They adjourned at midnight, minutes after the Senate had passed a tax bill. The session will be largely remembered for the passage of legislation to legalize same-sex marriage, but DFL Senate Majority Leader Tom Bach says he'll remember it for passing funding for statewide all-day kindergarten, which he says will benefit his grandchildren.
I know it's going to make a difference in their development as they get into elementary school and high school, and it's going to make a difference in the lives of a lot of people. It's going to make a difference in our future economic growth as we started investing in our youngest learners.
Republican Senate Minority Leader David Hand, though, says 2013 was a session of overtaxing, overspending, and overreaching by the majority Democrats.
We've seen a lot of spending that has been simply status quo, putting more money into existing programs, paying off political allies, very, very little reform, nothing that really addresses the fundamental problems that we face and recognizing that we have to do things differently, and raising a whole lot of new taxes and revenues to solve a relatively manageable $600 million budget problem.
Supporters of increasing the state's minimum wage had hoped for a last-minute deal. That never happened. Senate Majority Leader Bach says he expects that will happen, though, next year. Best Buy reported an $81 million first quarter net loss today as the company lowered prices to compete with online rivals. Martin Moylan has more.
Excluding restructuring and some other charges, the company actually exceeded Wall Street's expectations. But the retailer warned continued price competition could squeeze profits in coming months. CEO Hubert Joly made Best Buy's policy of matching internet competitors' prices permanent after starting it during the holiday season to win back sales. Sales at Best Buy stores open at least 14 months fell 1.3% in the quarter. Best Buy attributed the revenue weakness partly to a shift in the timing of Super Bowl-related sales. The big game took place on February 3rd, so pregame sales of big-screen televisions happened in the previous quarter. This year's first quarter was also 1 week shorter. Martin Moylan, Minnesota Public Radio News.
A proposal before a Wisconsin legislative panel would make it harder to recall a local Wisconsin elected official from office. The Assembly's Committee on Campaigns and Elections is slated to discuss the legislation today. The measure would require anyone who petitions to recall an elected official to prove that person has been charged with a crime or an ethics violation. North Dakota Congressman Kevin Cramer is defending comments he made this month linking legalized abortion to school shootings. The North Dakota Republican says his commencement speech at the University of Mary was about the erosion of American culture. He says political correctness now seems more important than political disclosure. And that is the latest regional news here on the Daily Circuit. But as we've been hearing all morning, the legislature finished its work before the midnight deadline. Last night, there is now a budget in place, and a big chunk of that state budget, $15.6 billion over the next 2 years, will go for pre-K through 12, grade 12 education. So I want to spend a few minutes poring over what is and isn't there in the budget for schools and what other policy matters didn't happen. DFL State Representative Paul Marquardt is on the phone. He chairs the Education Finance Committee in the State House. He's also a school teacher in northwestern Minnesota. Good morning, Representative.
Well, good morning. Great to be with you.
Glad you're with me. One of the things here that is not in the budget that got a lot of attention was this shift, a lot of borrowing against future school payments. One of the things that House candidates kept saying was that they had this campaign promise to pay back the shift, and now that's not happening through anything that you've done in this budget. It is happening because there was another law on the books. Would you say you've broken your promise on that, Representative?
You know, at the beginning of the year, we said we're going to do two things in education. Number one, pay back the shift that we owe back to our students and our schools. And number two, invest in those things that will really make a difference in moving our state forward for our kids. And we did both. What we do is we had a plan earlier in the year to pay back the shift with a surcharge. what we found out is with the economy chugging along pretty well, that we could do it another way without raising a surcharge or raising taxes. And what we do, and it's not the first time it's been done, mm-hmm. is we will accelerate basically the payment recognition, which means right now, in the first 3 months after the February forecast, we've had increased revenue of about $300 million over what was expected. Our shift that we owe to pay back to the 90-10 shift, 90% payments, 10% later, is about $275 million. And so what we will ask the Minnesota Management and Budget Office to do is on June 30th, when we know exactly what are all the numbers, what is the surplus, these are actual numbers, is that by September they have to certify that and then pay that off to the schools.
So you're saying
provided a mechanism to do that, and we will get that done.
And what you're saying is of the billion-plus dollars that was borrowed, that was shifted, all but $275 million has since been paid back because these forecasts have come in higher. But as we parse words here, though, as you noted, you didn't actually have to do anything. This law was already in place to allow for these automatic paybacks of the shift. So do you really get to take credit for paying back the shift when, frankly, it would have happened anyway?
It's in state law, but there is no sense in raising taxes. Why would you want to raise taxes on folks if, in fact, you have something in place, and instead of waiting to the November forecast, we actually are changing law to actually pay that back as soon as we know that the shift money is there. And so you take what you get. What we promised folks that we would do is pay back the shift, and we're going to have that done probably before we even come back next year. And the other thing on top of that is we were able to invest over $500 million into getting our kids to the world's best workforce. And, you know, you look at what we did this year, for the first time in the history of the state, we're funding all day, every day kindergarten, and then significant investment in early education, which will, as we all know, give people and students that jump start mm-hmm. that leads to great success in the future.
We're talking to DFL State Representative Paul Marquardt. He chairs the Education Finance Committee in the State House. We're talking about the K-12 budget and other K-12 policies, pre-K as well, that took place at the Capitol this year. And you noted that the budget includes money. There's a basic formula increase of about $234 million. That's kind of just the basic general formula that all districts get. But there's also $133 million for all-day kindergarten. And a point of order here, Representative, is that a mandatory thing now? Will every student in Minnesota have to take all-day K, or is that optional?
That would be voluntary. So our assumptions are probably about 95% of the students that are eligible will actually go into kindergarten, but that is voluntary still.
You also have $40 million in this budget for early childhood education spending. It's for scholarships for parents to send their students and their children to these early childhood education centers where they have a certain rating from a system here. The governor had originally asked for $40 million for that, so he got it. And then he'd also asked for $40 million for all-day K. So he had asked for the same for both. But what ended up happening was $133 million for all-day K and still that $40 million for early childhood. Why did it end up with such a big difference from what the governor had recommended between all-day K and early childhood education?
The biggest threat we have to our future economic vitality is the achievement gap. And when I talk about the achievement gap, that is the fact that our students of color and students of poverty are scoring at about one-half the rate on the math tests and graduating at about one-half the rate as their white student counterparts. Mm-hmm. And that's a huge threat to our economy. In fact, economists will say that our achievement gap in this state over the next 15 to 30 years, if we don't improve work productivity and close that achievement gap, it's going to cost about $5 billion of lost productivity into our economy annually into the future. And when you put that into perspective, that's like losing 5 Viking Stadium, that economic impact. And so we know that early on, that makes the biggest difference. If you can prevent the achievement gap from ever beginning. It saves you billions of dollars trying to close the achievement gap later. So we went with the $40 million in early education, which you have to remember is about a 7 times increase over the $6 million we had before. Huge, significant increase. And on the all-day, everyday kindergarten, we're moving from paying about 60% to completely paying that. So
right.
We wanted to make sure this year that we finally fully funded all-day kindergarten and then made huge, significant increases in early childhood. And the more you can put in early childhood, the better it is. But going from $6 million to $40 million was very significant. And into the future, those two things, the early childhood education, the all-day kindergarten, is really going to make the huge gains of putting our kids on the path to the world's best workforce. And that's the goal of that education plan.
I wonder if there's also a large difference, and not to belittle, you know, the money that is there, but there's such a big difference. There's so much more money for all-day K in this bill. Is that a result of a turf war between the existing K-12 system, which would handle kindergarten, and the not-so-necessarily public school district-run early childhood centers across the state?
Well, it's great that I think we have kind of two different systems there. We do have the public schools, the all-day K, and the scholarships, a little different format where students who are under 185% of the poverty level would be able to go to Head Start, school-based daycare center, absolute where the parent would want to send them. So it's a little different structure for both. Yes, you already have the infrastructure in place for all-day, everyday kindergarten and the public schools. And so that was important. You know, it's been years that if you followed it, all the years where we've tried to fund all-day, everyday kindergarten, because not only the studies show how successful it is, but the parental demand for that. I mean, already 43,000 students are in all-day, everyday kindergarten. And about 10,000 of those students, parents are paying fees up to about $26 million a year. So that's going to save those parents those dollars besides providing the all-day, everyday kindergarten, which shows such significant gains.
With this education budget in place now, with the increases in funding that were passed, Representative Marquardt, what would be your message to any local district? We talk about the inequity of school funding, that some districts can afford to go out and ask for property tax increases. Others can't, or they'll never win it at the polls. Should any district this fall be asking their residents for local property tax increases, given the boost that's here in this state budget?
Every school's going to be a little different. But what's important, too, is there was a piece in the bill that if you have zero on a referendum, it will bring you up to $300. That revenue is provided through levy and aid. So one of the things that we've seen in the state is that the inequity, the disparity between the low-revenue school districts and the high-revenue school districts has increased by about 67%. This will close that, which I think is really, really important. But whether or not a district needs to go for a referendum, you have to remember in the last decade, we have been disinvesting in education way below the inflation rate. And many of the schools are really hurting. But in the second year of this bill, there is really significant increase in resources. And I guess the message that would come out of this wouldn't go to the schools necessarily, but to the state overall. And it is that we are serious about closing the achievement gap. With the world's best workforce goals, we are saying that the state will strive to completely close the achievement gap, have every kid graduate, have every kid ready and reading properly by the third grade, and have every child ready for career or college. It's a very ambitious and bold plan with accountability measures. And what we are saying to every single parent is that we're not going to give up on any child. It doesn't matter who they are, what's their family income, where they live, they're going to have the opportunities to succeed. And what we say to a business, either looking at coming into Minnesota or current businesses, is that as a state, we have now sent a loud and clear message that we're going to provide you with the world's best workforce, the most talented workforce in the world. And that really is the goal of this education reform this year.
So you're not going to say one way or another whether local districts should go out for those levies. Before we go, though, Representative Marquardt, one final question. There was a lot of attention on this bullying prevention legislation that ended up not passing this year. Supporters hope it happens next year. One of the reasons for opposition, or one of the things that opponents cited, was that it's too costly for districts to implement if you have to keep track of all these things and do all this stuff. Do you believe that this bill would be too costly at the local level for districts to actually implement?
I don't believe it's too costly. I do believe there is a cost. I mean, we have to recognize that. 2 years ago, when the teacher evaluation system was put in place, and that I've seen reports of up to $200 million a year, there was no funding attached. And it's unfortunate that we do that. In our bill, we did pay for a potential bullying bill. I mean, there's other ways in which they could use those monies. But I'm always concerned when we set policy here in St. Paul that actually causes unfunded mandates. But we're still looking at that. There's about a $20 million cost that's projected for an anti-bullying bill. We need to make sure we have money available or scale that back.
DFL Representative Paul Marquardt, chair of the Education Finance Committee in the House, shepherded the education budget bill through the legislature here in the last week. Thanks so much for your time. I appreciate it.
You're welcome. Thank you.
Carrie, in other news this hour, the state medical examiner's office in Oklahoma is expecting more victims of yesterday's tornado to be found today. But for now, the official death toll is at 24. That was revised downward from an initial tally of 51 dead. That higher number reflects what is believed to be double counting that happened on the ground and at funeral homes. A leading U.S. Senate Democrat says the Internal Revenue Service's targeting of conservative groups was intolerable, and he's promising to get to the bottom of how it happened. Democrat Max Baucus made his remark as his panel, the Finance Committee, began Congress's second hearing on the extra scrutiny that the IRS gave Tea Party and other conservative groups seeking tax-exempt status. And police in Paris say Notre Dame Cathedral has been evacuated after a man committed suicide in the 850-year-old monument and tourist site. A police official says officers closed the cathedral to the public after the incident this afternoon. They wouldn't say what happened, only that the building is evacuated. That is highly unusual for Notre Dame, which is visited by some 13 million people from around the world every year. More coming up here on the Daily Circuit.
Tomorrow, you'll meet the man who hopes to be the first Somali-American on the Minneapolis City Council.
I'm interested in changing people's lives. And this community, they need to see themselves, a positive image of themselves.
I'm Phil Picardi. That story on the next Morning Edition.
Coverage of health and medicine on the Daily Circuit is supported in part by the United Health Foundation, helping people lead healthier lives and create brighter futures. More at unitedhealthfoundation.org.
I'm Carrie Miller, and now we're in depth on finding and training better teachers. I've moderated dozens of shows and debates about education reform. No Child, Race to the Top, Charters, Private versus Public, Class Size, The Achievement Gap, you name it. But a new report that studied school reform in three large cities reveals that most of those reforms aren't working. You can read the report on our website and the method the group used to study education reform. That lack of progress isn't going to surprise our guest. Education scholar and Harvard professor Yul Mehta is out with a new book about the history of the attempts to remake our public schools. But our conversation today is going to zero in on what he says about teachers. As he wrote in a recent op-ed, on the whole, we still have the same teachers in the same roles with the same level of knowledge in the same schools with the same materials and much the same level of parental support. Doesn't sound like much change, does it? Professor Mehta is going to join us in a moment. I want to hear from you, too. If you're an educator, do you think we need to raise the standards, the training, the skills of teachers? How do we draw a higher quality of student into the teaching profession? And if you're a parent, do your child's teachers truly excel? Maybe you have some thoughts about how to draw more people into the profession, how to raise the quality of teaching, raise the skill level of teachers. Weigh in this morning. Here's the phone number, 651-227-6000, 800-242-2828. You go to the Daily Circuit page and click on the Hour Show to comment. And you can reach me on Twitter at @CarrieMPR. Joel Mehta is an associate professor, I should say, at the Harvard Graduate School of Education, where he also does research on public education. His new book is titled The Allure of Order, and he joins us this morning from Harvard. And Professor, welcome. It's good to have you with us.
Thank you for having me.
I want to address this issue right up front, because I think we're going to hear plenty of people call today, and if they don't call, they're muttering to their radios, including educators themselves, who are going to hear the discussion, and they're going to say you're scapegoating teachers for a lot of the problems with the education system that they simply can't control.
Yes, that is a frequent response, and that is definitely not the intent of my work. So two issues. One relates to poverty. Whenever you start talking about teachers and school-related factors in general, people say, you know, haven't you seen what's happened in our cities? We have very high levels of child poverty by international standards.
Right.
And those things really need to be taken into account in improving schools. And I do not disagree with that. And I agree with that 100%. So that's kind of issue number one. With respect to teachers within schools, I mean, research has shown what parents have long known, which is that teachers are the most important school-related factor in children's education. And what I'm trying to talk about is really the difference between kind of teachers and teaching. I think we're in a climate right now where there's heavy emphasis on teacher evaluation systems and trying to measure whether individual teachers are or are not doing the job that we want them to. And I'm more interested in thinking about it as a kind of a systems problem, that we don't develop the kind of pay, knowledge, training, the kind of system we would need to build if we wanted consistent educational outcomes at scale. And in fact, I think that we make a big mistake by emphasizing holding individual teachers accountable for results when we haven't built the kind of system that we would need to produce the outcomes that we want.
You know, although when you focus on drawing what you say is a higher quality of student into teaching, that sounds to me like you're zeroing in on individuals.
So if you look at the international comparisons, the PISA test, which is given to 15-year-olds and measures how well students are doing in math, reading, and science, and these are fairly conceptual tests. They are not basic skills tests. They measure students' ability not just to do basic procedures, but also to apply those procedures and sort of use them. So I think that comparatively speaking, they're pretty good tests. The countries that come out on top of that, Japan, Korea, Finland, Canada, so the East Asian countries, which has been the story for a long time, but now also some other countries from around the world, they tend to draw their teachers from the top third of the high school or college test distribution. And so while it's certainly possible that there are not just possible, but there are clearly lots of good teachers out there in both the U.S. and elsewhere who themselves may not have been the strongest candidates at 20 or 21, if we think about it as a kind of system problem from the perspective of a whole, I think that's the direction we want to go. I'll just give you a quick anecdote.
Sure.
I was in Canada as part of an OECD study, and I went to a school, and I said to a young teacher who was about 24, you know, was it hard to get into teaching here? The policymakers are telling me it's really difficult to become a teacher here. And he said, yes, I had a number of friends in college who wanted to become teachers but didn't have the grades to essentially become teachers.
Wow.
And he said, but, you know, there's a loophole. And I said, what's that? And he's like, well, you can just go over the border to the U.S. Anybody can get credentialed over there. So that's how we look from the perspective of elsewhere in the world. And that's one of the things that we need to change. So I think if teaching became a more attractive profession, a lot of people would want to go into it. And hopefully things would get better.
You know, I want to note, while you've brought Korea, South Korea and Finland and some of the other countries that have been studied for the quality of their teaching. And this is something that really surprised me. You made comparisons with teacher hours and effectiveness with these other countries. And you note that teachers in places like Finland and South Korea spend significantly less time actually teaching in the classroom. And yet the student scores are higher. And those countries have among the best public education systems in the world. But the teachers are not in the classroom as long as our teachers are. So how can that be?
So just to put my professor hat on for a minute, I would be remiss if I didn't say it's really hard to draw causal conclusions across very different countries and very different systems.
But you did write about this.
I did. You know, you go with the best information that you have at a given moment in time. A key part of it is the planning. I mean, in Japan, for example, there's a thing called lesson study, which is where teachers come together and they work over time to refine a particular lesson. So one teacher might teach it and then another teacher might teach it. And then when that lesson is finished, they have a phrase for that. It's dropped like a stone into the kind of common repository of how you teach that particular lesson and that particular content. So if you look at the figures that I cited are correct. In Japan and South Korea, in high schools, teachers teach between 500 and 600 hours. And in the U.S., the number is 1080. So that's, you know, 70%, 80% more. And that time in other countries is used for common planning. Whereas in the U.S., it's not uncommon for teachers to have two, three, even four preps. They're preparing four different classes in a given day. And in that kind of situation, you know, I'm a professor. I teach, you know, four classes twice a week, and it takes me the better part of the week to come up with those four classes. So if you compare what our teachers are being asked to do, it's really, really difficult. So to tie this back to your initial question, it's not only about selecting, making the profession a more selective one. It's about making the profession a more reasonable one. If teachers had time to collaborate, if students were better supported outside of school with respect to poverty, the job would become much more doable. Since I wrote that Times op-ed, I heard from a lot of older teachers who said, you know, look at what the profession has become. I wouldn't urge my son or daughter to get into the field the way things look right now. And that's not the kind of signal that we want to send to our young people.
Let me grab a call here from Jacques in Hopkins. Jacques, you're a veteran educator, is that right?
Yes, I've been in the teaching profession for 22 years. And I guess over my career so far, my observations are that there's one determining factor in student success. I think we have highly qualified teachers. I think that teachers do as much as they can to bend over backwards to help students before and after school. We provide resources like YouTube videos, Moodle resources. And the big thing that I see that definitely determines whether or not a student's successful is the amount of effort level they put in mm-hmm. in order to be successful. And so one of the things I've observed in the near past, I guess, and currently, is that students who are willing to take the time to come up and ask questions, to work during their work time, and then to study at home to be prepared for assessment, is that if they do those things, they will be successful. I was telling your screener that in my current Algebra 2 class, we have 70% of our grade based on assessments and 30% on homework. And if a student does all their homework and even maintains a 60% level on the assessments, they'll end up with a C- in the course. So it's very difficult to not be somewhat successful if you're willing to put in the effort level. And so it seems like even though our society is very appreciative and applauds teachers for the effort they put in, everybody wants to seem to find a magic bullet or a solution. But the truth is that students themselves determine their own future by the effort level that they're putting in.
Joel Mehta, what do you think of that?
I think that that is right on. Clearly, students' effort and motivation is critical to learning at all levels. My colleague at Michigan likes to say that at the college level, there's not that much teaching, but there's a lot of learning, i.e. making fun of our fellow professors for their lack of pedagogical skill, but noting that students who are really motivated to learn can learn a lot. And I think the same thing is true in K-12. I think the question, though, is whether there are ways in which schools could be made more kind of interesting and engaging places. The Gates Foundation did a study of 3,000 sampled classrooms, and they found that 60-plus percent were what they called kind of competently managed, so students sitting at their desks doing their work, things moving along as they should. But that only 20% of those classrooms were engaging in what they called ambitious instruction, pushing kids to think, challenging them, giving them interesting and open-ended questions. And so one question I would have is, What are the possibilities for engaging kids in a kind of variety of ways? One of the most sort of unfortunate things I think about the testing movement right now
is... Well, I was just going to say, I think we're going to have teachers call up and say, stop teaching to the test. How can you have that kind of ambitious instruction when it's really all about a test?
Yeah, I'm moving closer and closer to your teachers as this discussion goes on.
You are. To the phones to Barbara in St. Paul. Hi, Barbara.
Hi. I have a student, or a son, that's currently a college student and has done quite well at a competitive school. He went through the St. Paul Public Schools. Mm-hmm. And through the process from elementary school through high school, he had some amazing teachers that were just wonderful and some that were not so good. And there are obviously a lot of variables that make a student successful, but I think to engage new teachers and keep teachers that are really, really high quality, they need to feel respected and to feel that they have some input into things that are going on in their classrooms and in their buildings. And without that, we're going to lose them. And that doesn't cost any more money. Administrators can make them feel valued and respected, or they cannot. And again, like I was saying, that doesn't cost any money.
What did you find in whether teachers feel empowered to kind of direct the curriculum and have some freedom within the classroom to experiment and to, you know, to do what they do best, I guess?
Well, I think that my son went to a public Montessori school, so the curriculum was fairly well set. And yet I saw some administrators come in that really wanted to, you know, maybe they were driven by the need to increase test scores or something, but they wanted to make changes. And I don't think that they really listened to the teachers and what the teachers found successful with their students.
Professor, what do you think?
Yeah, I think that's exactly on the right track. It's I say towards the end of the book that districts should empower schools to make many more decisions. Principals should be able to manage things like budget, like their budgets, which is critical for any organization. It's hard to run anything if you can't allocate where the money goes, and that successful schools are clearly comprised of places where teachers are trusted and respected, where new teachers are brought on board in part at the selection of the existing teachers. And Barbara's exactly right that would be inexpensive and would make the field much more attractive. One other point on that, though, sort of skeptical people, particularly if we're thinking about achievement gaps, as was raised mm-hmm. in the previous segment, would
yeah.
say, you know, if we empower teachers, you know, what about the teachers who are, you know, not as knowledgeable or pushing students forward? You heard Barbara say with her son that he had some phenomenal teachers and some less so. And part of what I'm arguing is that if we had more selection and extensive training at the beginning of teachers' careers over the first 3 or 4 years, so that when a teacher became a tenured teacher, it really meant something. It sort of showed that they had mastered certain skills that were requisite to become a teacher. If you did that up front, then you could decentralize things further sort of on the back end. So you wouldn't need the same degree of testing and kind of are we measuring everything every day, because you'd have some confidence in the folks as a whole, not just the best folks, but in all of the folks to run the schools.
Do you think there's enough of the concept of peer review where master teachers are fully aware of where the teachers that don't have that same amount of experience or just aren't as good of what's happening in those classrooms, and are coaching and mentoring some of these newer teachers? Is there enough of that going on?
No. No, there's clearly are good strategies. Peer review started in Toledo and was a program whereby teachers were responsible for mentoring, as you said, and helping and giving opportunities to improve other teachers. And then when necessary, kind of counseling out teachers if it really wasn't working out. It's hard to run any kind of field if you can't ever fire people if they're if things are not working out. But what that does is it elevates the status of the profession. I do a lot of comparisons with medicine, law, higher education, engineering, accounting, et cetera.
Right.
And one thing that characterizes professions is that the profession is responsible for developing knowledge, for setting standards of entry, and for creating norms of kind of ongoing practice, and peer review would be one part of that.
You actually suggest that teachers have to pass some kind of a, you know, the equivalent of a bar exam. So what would that look like? How would that work?
So if you have any lawyers out there in the audience, I can hear them about to raise their hands and say, yes, but our first-year associates, they don't know any law. They went to law school and they passed the bar exam and they don't really know any law. So don't impose that on any other field. What I'm really thinking of, Randy Weingarten used that phrase, I think, pretty intentionally to try to get attention to the idea, the head of the American Federation of Teachers. But what I really would favor is more of a board exam like they have in medicine, which is a kind of staged exam over time. So before you started teaching in your first year, you would pass a sort of pencil and paper test that showed that you knew your subject and knew a little bit about pedagogy. And then over the first 3 years, you would be mentored in a kind of apprenticeship style, similarly to a residency stage in medical school. And then at the end of that, you would take an exam, which would be in part paper and pencil, but in part it would reflect the work of your students, and in part it would draw on observations of your teaching. And that kind of composite measure would sort of demonstrate your ability to be to move from kind of a provisional to a certified.
That, you know, that seems
teacher.
Like a great idea. What's stopping districts or the profession from getting serious about that?
Well, I think there may be more interest in it. One of the positive byproducts of these international comparisons is that they show that there really are different ways of organizing the teaching profession. In Finland, 1 in 10 applicants to ed school gets in. I teach at the Harvard Graduate School of Education. I've visited at Stanford, and you know, I would say at our schools it's more like 4 or 5 in 10, and we're among the most selective institutions in the country. So what's stopping it? I mean, the clear fear is teacher shortages, that if you raise the bar and you didn't make accompanying shifts in salary, that people would just choose to go elsewhere. But I don't think that's necessarily the case, as we can see from these international countries. In some of these countries, teachers get paid a lot more, and some it's just time, status, and respect, and not pay. So there are a number of different ways to kind of slice the apple.
Joel Mehta is with us from the Harvard Graduate School of Education, where he also does research on public education. We're talking about the new book out called The Allure of Order, High Hopes, Dashed Expectations, and the Troubled Quest to Remake American Schooling. So he writes a lot about the history of education reform in this country. But I wanted to zero in on teachers, and he's done a lot of writing about that. We're talking about his ideas for reform, and we also want to hear yours. If you're an educator, how do we raise the standards, the training, the skills of teachers? How do we draw a higher quality of teacher into the teaching profession? What do you think about what he's saying about the professionalization of the teaching profession? If you're a parent, do your child's teachers truly excel? Tell me about what you think about some of the ideas we're talking about this morning. 800-242-2828, 651-227-6000. You can reach me on Twitter, at Carrie NPR, and we've got a good conversation going on here at the Daily Circuit page. Hey, Steph.
Hi, Carrie. Sam says, my concern is that it appears that teachers want it all. Tenure, auto pay raises, benefits, guaranteed retirements. Meanwhile, our community's workforces have had layoffs, pay freezes and reductions, reduced benefits, no tenure. If teachers want tenure, I wish they would take responsibility to do the firing within their departments and not push it off on the administration, whose hands are tied. Why are there teachers who show cartoon videos every week during class? It may be only a few, but why are there any?
We'll come back to tenure after a look at the news. Hi, Tom.
Hi, Carrie. President Obama says he's instructing his disaster response team to get tornado victims in Oklahoma everything they need right away. In comments this morning at the White House, the president called the devastation in Moore, Oklahoma, quote, one of the most destructive tornadoes in history. He's declared a major disaster in Oklahoma and ordered federal aid to supplement state and local recovery efforts. The death toll in Moore was revised downward this morning to 24. Stock indexes are edging higher in early trading on Wall Street as investors look ahead to the Federal Reserve's next moves. Home Depot rose 3% after the retailer reported an 18% increase in income for its first quarter, as the housing market continues to recover. And golfers take note, anchoring the club will be illegal come 2016. That's the decision today by golf's governing body regarding a putting stroke that's been used by four of the last six major champions. The rule does not ban the long putters, only the way they're commonly used. Golfers will no longer be able to anchor the club against their bodies to create the effect of a hinge. There was fierce debate in the golf world over whether anchoring the club is hurting the game. More coming up here on the Daily Circuit.
I'm John McTaggart, president of Minnesota Public Radio. Strengthening communities has been part of our mission for more than 46 years, and over the last week, you brought that mission to life in new ways. You helped us complete another important and successful member drive, and so many of you directed your thank you gift to help others in our communities. I am always humbled by your generosity, but I am never surprised. Thank you so much.
Support for this program comes from Hunger Free Minnesota, which awarded grants to Neighborhood House St. Paul and Two Harbors Food Shelf for their innovative ideas to fight hunger. More information at hungerfreemn.org.
This is the Daily Circuit on Minnesota Public Radio News. Follow us on Twitter. We're at Daily Circuit.
This is the Daily Circuit. I'm Carrie Miller. Coming up at 11 o'clock, my conversation with Temple Grandin at the Fitzgerald Theater in front of a sold-out crowd. We talked about her new book. It's about the neuroscience of autism. Excellent conversation. You'll hear it in depth at 11 o'clock. But at the top of the hour, we're going to update the latest on the tornadoes in Moore, Oklahoma, and talk with two experts about the science of some of these monster tornadoes. So that's coming up at 11. This hour, Joel Mehta is with us. We're talking about his new book, The Allure of Order. It's about education reform, and I'm zeroing in on what he has to say about the teaching profession. Let's take up tenure here before we go back to the phones, because we do have a lot of people waiting to get in here, Professor. But what about the idea of tenure? The teachers' unions hang on to that quite fiercely. Is it part of the problem, or can it be part of the solution?
That's a good question, and I think it remains to be seen. I mean, one thing to remember for folks who are skeptical of teachers' unions is that a number of other countries around the world that outperform us in these tests do have strong teachers' unions, and one of the things they do is they push up salaries, which in turn makes it easier to draw people into the profession. So there are some benefits. Specifically on tenure, I think we kind of have two choices, which is either tenure will be gradually phased out, and you've seen some movements from state legislatures, mm-hmm. particularly on the conservative side, that it's sort of part of a broader skepticism of public sector employees. Or the kinds of things which I'm suggesting, which is I think tenure would have more support if there was a sort of clear sense that it wasn't just something that you were granted after a few years of teaching, but that it represented a sort of significant achievement like tenure at a university or becoming a partner at a law firm or, as you can imagine, across fields. If it were sort of seen as a more significant accomplishment, I think teachers would be in better shape to advocate for continuing it.
We have the president of the St. Paul Federation of Teachers on the line, Mary Catherine. Hi, Mary Catherine. Thanks so much for waiting to get in here.
Good morning. Yeah, thanks so much for having this topic. And thanks for the timing, because I did want to talk about the role of a teachers union to improve our profession.
Well, here's what I want to ask you about.
Yeah.
You just heard what Professor Mehta said about unions and tenure. Do you mm-hmm. believe that tenure ought to be something that's reserved for a certain amount of accomplishment in the profession, that it isn't just built into a contract and you get it at a certain at a certain time of your career?
Oh, my gosh. Absolutely. It's everything we've been doing at the St. Paul Federation of Teachers at our bargaining table. One of the things when I was first elected president, I realized that tenure could be an accident. And we wanted to insist that our contract made sure that never happened again. Tenure should be absolutely reserved for someone we are purposefully welcoming into our profession. And it means that you are now being provided due process, which again should go back to that intellectual freedom argument that your discussion about teachers you were having earlier in the show. Giving teachers that autonomy to make decision making, and now you have the due process to be able to defend your decision making now that we've welcomed you into the profession.
Do you think enough teachers are denied tenure? I mean, teachers that are mediocre.
In St. Paul, I do.
You do?
Absolutely. Yeah. We have an incredible peer assistance and review program that's available not just for probationary teachers, but for tenured teachers. And we launched it, though, with our probationary teachers. And we have contract language that says no teacher shall receive tenure without going through our peer assistance and review program, because we think teachers deserve that much support, and as well as that close a look at their work, meeting the needs of our kids before we would grant them tenure.
Mary Catherine, one of the things that Professor Mehta said in this op-ed in the Times that we've been talking about, and I read this quote in the introduction, I'm interested in what you say. On the whole, we still have the same teachers in the same roles with the same level of knowledge. I think that's important. In the same schools with the same materials and much the same level of parental support. Would you say there have been greater changes than what he is saying in that editorial?
That is a generalization, but I do think the seed of what he is saying, that seed idea, is absolutely right, and that is what we've been pushing up against. I think if you look at the arc of the teaching profession, we have been evolving. Absolutely. We are not the same teachers we were 50 years ago or 100 years ago, but that doesn't mean that arc may be moving as fast as it should. And I think, so obviously part of that, what is critical, is talking about the teaching profession. The other part he mentions, of course, is the parent involvement, the arc of parent involvement in school has been evolving as well, and not nearly as fast as it should, to really look at teaching and parenting as a partnership for a child's future.
Professor, is it evolving quickly enough, in your view?
Nothing ever changes as fast as any of us would like.
Well, I think for what the education system needs, let me put it that way.
No, I don't think so. I mean, I think if you just go and visit, I've been doing a study of what we're calling deeper learning, the kind of 21st century skills that we hope our students will be able to possess moving forward in high schools across the nation. And some of those were high poverty and working class schools, but some of them are middle class schools. And I think if you spent a lot of time in classrooms, you would still see a lot of students, the teacher presents a PowerPoint on the board, the students get given a worksheet that they're supposed to fill out. And if we're really serious about creating a workforce of kind of creative, thoughtful, open-ended, critical thinkers, we have a long way to go. And so to that end, I think that the pace of change is too slow. I would agree with Mary Catherine that when you write something in the New York Times, you have a modest number of words. You're trying to bring some attention to what you're saying. So, if you read the book version, there are 1,000 qualifications of that statement.
Yes.
But basically, I think, things are not changing fast enough, and we need more wholesale changes.
Well, let's note, I'm quoting from the book and from the Times editorials, yes, both. So we're putting you on the spot both ways, right?
Sure.
Here's to Jaya in Minneapolis. Hi, Jaya. Thanks so much for waiting.
This actually kind of speaks to that, too. I'm actually have been a teacher for years. I live in Minneapolis, but I lived in California and taught mostly in East Oakland. And what I really see right now, I'm getting my master's in educational technology. And it's really pretty unbelievable how little we've really updated our teaching practices, even in the last 100 years. I mean, even schools that have iPads and things, they're still just mostly playing games on them or, putting a worksheet on the iPad or doing things like that. And I just think teachers, from what I've seen, are extremely dedicated to their students, but they just don't have the teaching tools that are available on a mass level. You might have an iPad card that's shared between multiple classrooms with absolutely no training in how to really utilize that. And So I don't know if he could speak to that and just you talk about giving intro teachers more training, but really those teachers just came out of teacher programs and have the latest training. But across the board, if you've been teaching for 15 years, you have no idea really how to like suddenly be using these new skills. And kids aren't engaged. Yeah. You know, they're still using worksheets, and then they go home and make a multimedia presentation and put it on YouTube, and they're bored, you know? They're bored at school.
These are really good points, Professor. What can you say?
Right on. Yes, no, I think to that last point, right? So professions not only do training and certification at the beginning, they have kind of continuing, ongoing credits that you have to achieve to sort of maintain a member of the profession. And things like technology, you know, fractions and algebra probably haven't changed much in the last 10 years, but technology has changed dramatically. So should there be things in place that kind of push people to update their skills? Definitely. I think, though, that it's not just the teachers, it's the schools themselves, right? As long as schools are sort of broken up into I've been doing this study on high schools, so I've become more conservative the younger kids are, because I think kids need to learn how to read and do math and so forth. And the sort of further on they go, the more their interests should affect the directions that they take. But, you know, if high school is still going to be split up into sort of six blocks of 45 minutes each, and we're going to be learning from the biology and math textbooks and so on and so forth, we're not really opening up the space for even teachers like the one that you just had to, you know, create interesting interdisciplinary projects, draw on kids. You know, the kids know more about technology than we do, build on those skills and so forth. So in the long run, you know, we're clearly moving into a more kind of student-centered world where the rate of information is, you know, doubles every couple of years, and that information's at all of our fingertips and so on. And so the question is, you know, can we kind of update schools in a way that really take advantage of that?
You know, until you said that about high schools and how they're structured, I hadn't thought about how the way I went to high school and the way my parents went to high school and the way kids are going to high school today doesn't look that different, does it?
Yep. There's a famous book about this that calls that the grammar of schooling. It says that we essentially sort of layer on reforms like Christmas tree ornaments, but that the grammar of schooling basically stays unchanged.
To the phones to Mark in Anoka. Hi, Mark.
Yes, I'm a pediatrician. I work with new graduates and nurse practitioners. And one of the things I found very helpful to me is shadowing and mentoring new docs. I found it extremely helpful to me, especially working with specialists. Your analogy with physicians is a good one. I don't think the schools do enough of that to help new hires and ongoing. I think teaching is communication and motivation. That isn't taught in school.
Professor, how about that? In kind of the way that the medical profession does it.
Agreed. Teaching is craft as much as coming from a formal knowledge base. You need to know your subject, but you pick up a lot of kind of tacit knowledge from people who have experience in the field. And so much more extensive mentoring. I'd like to see team teaching in the first couple of years. It's one thing for a teacher who has her own load to come and, you know, give you some advice on your lessons. And it's another thing to be kind of daily co-planning lessons for a year or two. I think that really... where that has been tried, that really kind of ups the learning curve, because you really get to see on a sort of moment-to-moment basis what style of teaching looks like.
I found your ideas exhilarating and what you wrote about the pace of reform and the history of reform pretty troubling. And then I kind of wondered where these meet in your mind.
That's a great, great question. And I discovered in teaching my own students that I taught them the kind of so much reform, so little change story in the first half of the semester. And then in the second half of the semester, I tried to open up to them all of these possibilities. And invariably, I was more successful in the first half and was unable to undo what I had done in the second half. And so I moved to sort of thinking about kind of topics and problems and solutions as we go. So for each of the things that we've raised, you know, systemically, schools may not have changed, but there are schools out there which have really interesting interdisciplinary approaches to developing curriculum. There are, as you said, peer assistance and mentoring programs. There are induction programs. So for each of these things that we have cited, there are people out there that are developing really good solutions to them. The question is, could we sort of knit those things together and move the field forward at greater scale?
I hope we can keep talking about this. It was a really interesting conversation for me. I hope for you too.
I really enjoyed it, and I really enjoyed hearing from your listeners.
Great. Joel Mehta's new book is called The Allure of Order, High Hopes, Dashed Expectations, and the Troubled Quest to Remake American Schooling. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Carrie.
I want to see if I can get Tony in Decorah, Iowa in here. Tony, a word about leadership. Is that what you wanted to say?
Yeah. You know, I've been watching. I'm a retired educator. I had 38 years in education, and I listen and watch with interest the discussion about improving education, and the focus is so often on, or almost always on, teachers. And I want to just remind people that the leadership in a building has so much to do with the atmosphere for educators and for students. And so let's not forget to, you know, talk about principals and their role in improving education in a building, and superintendents also, and school boards. These people all help to set the tone that teachers teach within. And I've seen very good principals, and I've seen some very poor ones. And for teachers, the good ones make their job much easier and much more enjoyable.
Good point. Okay. Which I think goes to the mentoring and the professionalization that we were talking about.
Exactly.
As well.
That team teaching, I like that idea. I like to see teachers be able to teach and plan across the curriculum and have more time to prepare lessons.
Okay.
Time and money is a big issue.
Tony, I thank you for that. Steph off the Daily Circuit page.
Bob says, I've been in education for 40 years and not much has changed. Our problem? We collectively feel anyone can teach.
You can continue to add your thoughts to the Daily Circuit page. Steph Curtis will be taking a look at that. And you can also weigh in millennials. Don't forget, we're looking for your comments from our 9 a.m. hour as well about the issues that you care about and why Democrats should not take your votes for granted. At 11, my conversation with Temple Grandin. We'll also talk about tornadoes off the top. Stay with us.